The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of The Heretics Hour on this Monday, July 16th, 2012. I am Carolyn Yeager, and I'm coming to you live from the White Network. I would like to encourage you to help as many people as you can to discover the White Network. That's our newest theme that I would like to get something, get a little graphic designed for, designed on this, discover the White Network. That's what we want people to do. And many are, because our listeners and downloads of the programs are increasing very nicely. So I appreciate that I have a nice group of listeners listening to me right now. I appreciate those of you who do tune in live, because it's so easy to just download it and listen to it at your leisure, which is nothing wrong with that. But it is always nice to know that you have somebody listening to you when you're doing the program. So welcome to all of you. During tonight's two-hour program, I'm going to read and respond to emails that are sent to carolyn@carolynyeager.com. I don't have a guest tonight, the reason being that I want to go into several different areas, and it's just easier to maneuver around by myself when I do that. And although I welcome other viewpoints from my listeners tonight, and I will read them, although I know that's not as good as being able to call in and actually talk on the air. But we're still a little nervous about, we still haven't figured out the phone line. And if anybody has any help on that, please let us know. Also, I think we've both been pretty busy and quit putting attention on that. So we're still using emails, but we're moving along, and a lot of work has been done on the software that you wouldn't know by Tan Stoffel. He puts a lot of time into this, and he's done all kinds of things which to make the system more stable. And there's only so much, you know, he can't work 24 hours a day on it. He has other things he has to do. Right now, he's on a family vacation, and I hope he's having a good time. So tonight, I'm going to start off where I ended last week, which was talking about Mark Weber, director of the Institute for Historical Review. The overall topic was fundraising in the white nationalist and revisionist movement, or as I put it on the program page, where is the money going? Now, this was just the end of the program last week because I had other things that ended up taking a lot of time, and so I didn't get very far into this, so I promised that I would start in on it tonight, and I have got everything prepared now. So, where is the money going? Okay, now this is not that I think that I have to know or be told who gets money and from whom and what's being done with it. No, I'm only concerned with whether we seem to be effective. And if we're not making progress, is it that money is going into some black holes? Or, you know, I'm not here to point the finger at anyone. I'm not making myself into a hero or someone who you should send money to. I don't have any big plans for using money right at the moment, except what we need here for this network. But let me put it this way, okay? The issue we're dealing with is white genocide. Nothing less. Is this serious enough to get serious and ask serious questions of those who are supposedly in the forefront of this battle? And if they're not in the forefront, why are they asking for and receiving so much money from the white people who care about this? And I think there is a lot of money. We always say we don't have any money. You know, the other peoples have all the money. Well, of course, it's true. The kind of money we have compared to our enemies, if I could call them that, is negligent. But it is still a substantial amount of money that is being sent around all over the place. And the only one that I know that we can tell is the Institute for Historical Review, because They are a one of those, is it 503 or 5013 or something, nonprofit organization, and they have to file every year, and it's public, it's made public. So you can look and see what, at least what they've put down for the authorities to look at as to what money came in and what they, what expenses they had and what was done with it. I don't know if anybody else has such a, you know, I don't know, I haven't heard of any others that you can look at these kinds of filings. This is all, this is, if we can, whatever we can look into, it's worth looking into, I think. So I've taken a closer look than I ever had before at just a few of our high-profile organizations and leaders. In what I loosely call the white movement, but I have to call it the white and revisionist movement, because they're not the same necessarily, unfortunately, and they're not, you know, there's, it's not easy to define. So because I've taken a look at this, because if we are doing our job, they are what we should monitor, right? I mean, they're doing their job, supposedly, and if the rank and file is doing their job, they should be monitoring and paying attention to these people in leadership positions. I think rather than just try to applaud and support and speak well of them, that's all important. But I think we also have to do our job. We should be looking more closely, because isn't this what we criticize in our general society, that in political correctness, all these people in leading positions and politicians and heads of organizations and so on, they get away with everything because nobody checks enough and nobody pays enough attention, and when you do, it's hard to find it. But you know, we talk a lot about there's a lot of criticism of CEOs and the kind of salaries they get and the kind of retirement benefits they get, whether they do a good job or not, and because of the economy for the last quite a while, they didn't look like they were doing a very good job, and shareholders were losing money, etc., etc. But they still walked away with huge payments when they were let go and they brought somebody else in who would do a better job, they hoped. You know, these people all got super, super rich. And there's all this criticism of that. And we don't want to be doing the same thing, even if on a much smaller scale. So if we're unwilling to question and demand answers from these people because it might make our side look bad, we're not different from these ones I just described. So because there's a lot of information about the IHR, and for other reasons too, I'm going to return to that, because I kind of took a bunch of highlights and didn't really go into it in a careful way last week. So I'm going to return to this and try to cover what I didn't last week. And the IHR has been engaged in great controversy over the years. So it's not like, you know, I'm just, I or anybody else is just picking on the current director of the IHR for no reason or out of meanness or something, but because there are a lot of questions to be asked, and even still, there are so many people who are not at all happy with what goes on there and how it's being handled. And I'm going to go into that question that some people bring up. Well, they do what they want to do. It's up to them, and it's not up to anybody to criticize. If you want to do something different, or if you think something different should be done, then you start your own and do that. Well, that's not a good argument, friends, because knowing the history of the IHR is that it was founded by other people than the ones who are in charge of it today. And it was, as many of you know, and probably most of you listening to me And many who will listen already know this story, but you're still interested in it, so there's still more to think about it. But you basically know what happened, and that it was a Holocaust revisionist organization with a lot of people, a lot of revisionists involved in it. And at some point, it was under the control of Willis Carto. I don't want to go into this history. I don't even have it written down in front of me. But all of a sudden, I'm finding myself thinking I should cover this just a little bit. Because just speaking about the controversy. So I think I have this all down in my notes. It is further down in what I'm going to be saying. So maybe I won't go into this too much right now, but it was taken over in a sense from Willis Carto by the revisionists, and leading that group or someone who did a lot of the work involved in it was, what's his name now? Mark Weber was Mark Weber. And so Mark Weber was one of the, Greg Raven at the end of this whole mess that took place became president. Mark Weber was secretary and a director. And Ted O'Keefe was a director and treasurer. And then they had some other directors. And then they were supposed to carry on from there, and that's when things started to not go so well. Not so much work was being done, and there are a lot of difficulties within the personnel that were there. So that's and then it changed itself quite a bit. Now I'm rambling, so I need to get on with what I've got organized here, and wait on going over that again when I get to it. So first let's look at the IHR self-description, because it's changed from what it was originally. The IHR now calls itself, on its website and anywhere you look, an independent educational research and publishing center that works to promote peace, understanding, and justice through greater public awareness of the past. So, you know, the important part here is that it works to promote peace, understanding, and justice. And then it says it's recognized as a 501c3 public interest, not-for-profit, tax-exempt enterprise, which it always was, I think. Donations are tax-deductible. Now, compare to what the original wording of how the IHR defined itself before it was changed, and it said the IHR is an independent educational research and publishing center that works to promote peace, understanding, and justice through greater public awareness of the past. Okay, got rid of. I think I got the wrong one here now. No, that's the same one. I copied that wrong. I have to go all the way back down here to find that. Darn it. I'm sorry. I just did that, though. I better bring that up to the top so I can. Okay. Here it is. Let me bring this up here. Funny I did that. Put this in here. All right, now, at that time, before, it said the Institute for Historical Review claims to be, forget the claims to be. What it said was, how it described itself was an educational public interest research and publishing center dedicated to promoting greater public awareness of the past and especially socially politically relevant aspects of 20th century history. So that's quite different from what it changed into. It was, it calls itself a publishing center. Well, it still called itself a publishing center. But it's dedicated to promoting greater public awareness of the past. That's why it's called Historical Review. And especially socially, politically relevant aspects of 20th century history. That was taken out, and it is now just left greater public awareness of the past. And it's not dedicated to promoting public awareness of, well, sure, especially socially, politically, social political aspects of 20th century history, but it's now focused on promoting peace, understanding, and justice. What is that? I find those words very strange. What has that got to do with an institute that has should have some kind of a purpose for what kind of intellectual work it's doing? How do you promote peace, understanding, and justice through greater awareness of the past? It's all really watered down. So then they say today what we accomplished through meetings, interviews, lectures, online outreach. Online outreach mainly means emails, you know, reaching out to people through email. Now we have meetings, okay, some interviews, some lectures, websites. Well, they have a website. They always had a website. And distribution of books, discs, and flyers. Now, it doesn't say publishing of books CD discs and so on. It says distribution because IHR does not publish anything anymore. It used to publish, but now it just distributes books, old books that it has in its ownership. You know, it has an inventory of all these books that it had when it was taken, when it took over from the Carto management, and it hasn't sold all those books yet. There was a lot of them, I guess, thousands and thousands, thousands. Very valuable. And they don't, nothing is published, so now they just distribute. And it says, then they say it depends on support from men and women like you. To make a secure online donation, click here. Now, the IHR income has dropped quite a bit in the last couple of years. And since Weber made a shift in emphasis after the year 2000, and especially after 2005, we can judge how that was taken by IHR supporters by looking at the kind of contributions that came in. And according to these papers filed with the proper authority, I don't know what that group is called. It's probably not some government organization. The IHR income in 1997 was $70,820. In 1998, it was $99,781. And that is, you know, some time back, you know, that would be higher now, inflation-wise. But 1999, it jumped to $490,965. So obviously there was some big contributions that year. Something happened. I'm not sure what happened, and I wasn't able to find all that out. In the year 2000, it was $346,572. Well, let's just notice that this 99 and 2000 were really pretty strong figures and high amounts of money for any kind of an organization like this, revisionist type organization to be receiving. Now, in 2002, it went down a little to $250,000, and then in 2010, it was $140,000. So it's lost quite a bit over those years. We're going to look a little deeper into this. There's a website, markwebermustgo.blogspot.com, where you can find these files. There's a link to it it shows on the right side of the blog. It says that here's the papers, the financial reports. And you can go there, and there's a series of them. And the last one is 2010. So I looked at the last one and the first one, the 2010, where the income was $140,000, it said the prior year it was $175,000. So in 2009, now salaries were $47,000 and the prior year they were $67,000. Other expenses are listed as $87,000, the prior year $122,000. They have total expenses, it got crammed together here. Program expenses, I can't read this now because it got, unless I expand it, which I can't do. There's a program service expenses, which are, mainly, you know, what it costs them to put on their programs and do their work, which is what they're all about. And that is, consulting expenses were $31,000. I don't know who they're consulting with or why that is so high. Office costs for the program service expenses was $9,738, and this is 2010. A telephone bill was $3,000, and there was also another figure for management general expenses, but I'm not sure what all these things are. Then there's utilities was $2,100 in 2010. There was a fundraising expense for the cost of fundraising was $2,615. There's nothing, you know, outstanding in any of these, but when you have an organization like this, where you depend on income contributions, spend a lot of your time fundraising, and you have to spend you can spend quite a bit of money in your fundraising. Quite a bit of the money that comes in from fundraising you can use to do more fundraising. The total program service expenses for 2010 were $99,761. Now we have to ask, what was being done with that? What were these program services? What were these programs that were being done? Weber has said that he has a few meetings. He's increased that, he says, in the last couple of years. So in 2010, there were maybe not too many. Didn't put on any conferences. So what was this money being spent on? Well, we don't know, but in 2010, there were only six directors. Mark Weber was president and a director, and he is listed as working 40 hours a week. And the others are directors who don't work very, very little, and they don't receive any money. Gerald Domitrovic, Jack Reiner, Harvey Taylor, they have all been directors for since the beginning. Since the change, I don't know. That probably is when they came on. John Todd and Greg Hubbard are newer ones who were added when the two that were there before, which I'll mention further along, were fired, were asked to step down as directors because they opposed Mark Weber. And then there was a secretary who is not a director at all. Her name is Amada Dufault. She works as secretary. No hours listed, so I guess only when they have a meeting, which they probably don't have very often. Probably don't have one of these directors, these board of directors. They probably don't meet very often. So that's negligible. So in 2010, the only person who worked at the IHR was Mark Weber. He must be in there by himself with a few employees, doing whatever he does. There's nobody else. Now, in 2002, though, there was a little more going on. The contributions were $250,000. Program services expenses were $342,000, more than the contributions. Then there was a balance from the previous year of $59,000. So the ending net assets were minus $39,000. The compensation of officers and directors in 2002 was $115,500. Other salaries and wages, $36,000. Payroll taxes, $12,307. Now, a payroll tax, I think, must be Social Security for Weber, the three that were paid, Weber, Raven, and O'Keefe. There were legal fees in 2002 of $113,400. The telephone costs were $3,830. Occupancy, which I assume is their rent, some kind of rent, $41,442. Conferences, conventions, and meetings, $3,000 they spent on. And this is the purpose of the organization, but they spent $3,000 on this. And the total of all this, well, of the total of the expenses is $342,000, which I mentioned up above under program services expenses. So the cash on hand at the beginning of 2002 was $27,500. At the end of the year, it was $4,800. Don't know what happened there. They had a whole lot less cash. Went from $27,000 to $4,000. So that went somewhere. Inventory, that is books, CDs, and such things for sale that they have for sale, amounted to $155,000, and at the end of the year it was $144,000. These two filings, the 2002 and 2010, were different looking, and they were set up differently. So they changed the you know, the people who do this probably changed the form a little bit. So there's not the same kind of information on the later one as on this earlier one. And the oh, we have building, land and building depreciation. That was, it was only worth $7,000 by the end of the year, 2002, because it had been depreciated to that amount. The total assets at the beginning of the year, 2002, was $191,000. At the end of the year, it was $155,000. Mortgages, $123,000. Total liabilities, return earnings, endowment. You can't keep all this straight. So, total liabilities and net assets at the beginning of 2002, $191,000, and at the end, $155,600. So now I've got some years here, quite a few years, or several years, for gifts, grants, contributions. Somehow the year 1997 was there. $70,820 in 1997 of gifts, grants, and contributions. In 1998, it was a little higher, $99,781. But in 1999, it was $490,965, so almost $500,000. When it was under $100,000 the 2 years prior to that, something big came in. If something happened in 1999, that may be where all the problems started. In 2000, in the year 2000, it was $346,500 some in gifts, grants, and contributions. And then money taken in from admissions, merchandise, and services, $203,590 in 1997, $188,000 in 1998, less than that in the year 1999 when they brought in so much in gifts, grants, and contributions, and $201,000 in 2000 when they had $346,000 in gifts, grants, and contributions. So, that year, 2000, was a pretty good year, and so was 1999. Now, contributors, they have listed here. Okay, they have the contributors listed in 2002 individually, although they don't give the names. They don't have to give the names, obviously, but they give the amounts. And one person contributed $17,000 to the IHR in 2002. Another person contributed $50,000 non-cash. I think that's the one that donated so many shares of Lucent stock, which was worth $50,000 at the time. Now, that probably went down to practically nothing, because Lucent did lose big time. That was the stock everybody wanted, and then it turned out, and then it crashed at some point. Then another contributor contributed $6,000, another one $10,000, somebody else $20,000, and finally someone $59,000 in 2002. So there are some big contributors to the IHR, major helpers. Then there were the staff was larger. There were among the directors. Well, Greg Raven was president then, and he was not listed as a director. He wasn't on the board of directors, but he was president. Mark Weber was secretary and on the board of directors. And Ted O'Keefe, who did a whole lot of writing and hard work at the IHR, was treasurer and on the board of directors. And then there are four just directors, the same Gerald Domitrovic, who is probably still there, and Jack Reiner and Harvey Taylor. And the person that wasn't there before was the one that got kicked off, Robert Lynch. It was Robert Lynch who, and maybe Reiner, but I think he's still there. So Robert Lynch, who was opposing Mark Weber on some things, and he was finally asked to step down, and they put these other two in his place, because also Ted O'Keefe was let go, and Greg Raven left. I haven't updated myself on all of that, how that happened, but I have read all about it in the past, but I didn't get to it this time. But I have something about him down below, written by Robert Forison. So so at this time in 2002, there were three paid officers: Greg Raven, Mark Weber, and Theodore O'Keefe. Raven was paid in 2002 $39,082. Mark Weber was paid $41,583. That's he was the highest paid there. Theodore O'Keefe, otherwise known as Ted O'Keefe, was the lowest paid. He got $34,885 for the year. Now, the gross profit from selling educational materials in 2002 was $36,000. So that's a gross. That's what they grossed in selling, I get books and so on that they had to sell. That's not a whole lot. But they got loans. Now, there were not new loans, but loans that were being carried in 2002. There was a loan from Andrew Allen for $188,000. It doesn't say when that loan was first made, but at the end of 2002, the IHR still owed $88,450 to Andrew Allen on that $188,000. So they had paid that down quite a bit. $100,000 already. And there was a loan from Fritz Berg for $5,000. And at the end of 2002, that was paid down to $2,750 that was still owed to Mr. Berg, but I imagine he's gotten his money by now. John Curry also loaned the IHR $62,696. And at the end of 2002, they still owed him $32,666. But none of those things were on the 2010 filing, or 2009 it was actually. They may have been taken care of by then. Now, from somebody wrote this, what's his name? Who did the blog spot? Who's done the Mark Weber Must Go? Why can't I think of his name? I'll think of it in a minute. Anyway, he wrote from 1995 to 2001, Mark was paid for doing a poor job for presiding over the destruction of the Journal of Historical Review. Therefore, he says Weber was overpaid during those years. So from 1995 to 2001, I guess he was one of this team. And sometime after that, he took over and everybody else left and there was just him left there. That's why I put this down here, because I'm trying to get this these years correct. And it says that Carto, this is what is his name, darn it? He's the revisionist. He's been working, he's put a lot of time into this, but now it's just sitting there for everybody to look at. He says that one of the reasons that Willis Carto was ousted is because he was not on the IHR board. He was the president or, you know, the whatever, the head of it. But he wasn't on he didn't put himself on the board of directors, which often happens. And therefore, the board of the directors voted to get rid of him. And that was what the big lawsuit was all about. But he says that Weber put himself on the board of directors right from the start. So, and this way, he's aware of what the board of directors are talking about. And if there's anyone who's talking, you know, in a way that he doesn't like or is opposed to him, he'll be asked to step down. And that's what happened to Robert Lynch. So I'm going to skip this for now, as I think I've got this twice. Now, I'm going to go through what Robert Faurisson wrote in 2009, because it explains a lot of the timeline of when things happened, how things happened. So I'm just taking some parts from this. Robert Faurisson said wrote of Mark Weber in 2009, I found in him a researcher endowed with good intellectual qualities and also a man who, whilst openly showing vigorous far-right convictions, seemed without character. He says it even seemed that if he so admired strength or energy, it was because he himself was weak, timorous, hesitant. In 1988, Weber was still a revisionist, testified as an expert witness at the Zundel trial in Canada. In the years that followed, before the growing difficulties encountered by revisionism, I think they see those difficulties in the 90s. He seemed to me to lose heart, Faurisson says. It was at this time that he, in all honesty, ought to have got off the revisionist ship openly and for all to see. Unfortunately, he preferred to keep his post at the IHR, and from 1995, the remuneration that came with the office of director. That is, from 1995, Mark, that's when the break came, and the revisionist group won the IHR from Willis Carto. And, you know, Willis Carto said that he wanted to turn the journal. They had the Journal of Journal of Historical Review going very well. It was coming out regularly. It was a bimonthly, every 2 months, just like the Barnes Review is now. And then he announced that he wanted to make it not only Holocaust revisionism, but he wanted to also make it historical revisionism about World War II and so on, and maybe even World War I and, you know, some of that. And, you know, the revisionists got all upset about that. They said, oh, he was going to take it away from revisionism, the Holocaust. He was going to do this. He didn't want to do that because, you know, the fact is he never has done that in all these years since. He is the one who continues publishing things about Holocaust, not the IHR. So these revisionists kind of made a mistake, and they thought that Willis Carto was too heavy-handed and so on. So they had got this plan, and Mark Weber was pretty much in the middle of it. But he wasn't the only one, you know, they said, this institute belongs to all of us. This institute doesn't belong to Willis Carto or one or two people. It belongs to the revisionists who are working here and writing this stuff and publishing in the Journal of the Institute of the the Journal of Historical Review and so on. You know, it belongs to us. And this was the argument that they used. And this was an argument that that they won with. I don't know if it's just this argument, but they did win in the courts. And now they're saying, well, this institute doesn't belong to Mark Weber. This institute belongs to revisionists. It was set up for revisionism, Holocaust revisionism, and that's. But you know, he's taken it, and now Mark Weber has pretty much done what they were charging Willis Carto of doing, taking it over and making it be what he wanted it to be. And now Mark Weber has taken it totally 100% away from Holocaust revisionism and only into historical revisionism. Well, it isn't even a journal or anything. He's really taken it nowhere. But the point I'm trying to make is that the argument that he made along with the other revisionists has turned around and done the very same thing that he was accusing Willis Carto of doing. And Willis Carto has never abandoned Holocaust revisionism, as I said. So it's kind of ironic. It's not kind of, it is ironic. And the point here that I wanted to get from here is that in 1995, it was in 1995 then that the revisionists took over and Mark Weber became one of the directors, and he was also secretary, so he got paid. And he did do a lot of writing then, and Ted O'Keefe did a lot of writing, and they're both paid. And Greg Raven, I'm not ever sure what he did, but he was supposed to be a pretty good guy, and he was the president. And they were putting out the journal and doing all the things that they did there. So our friend who's done all this expose, whose name I can't bring to my mind, I could go and look at something, but I don't want to. So he let his he says that Weber started playing a double game. No, Forrestan is talking here. What am I thinking? Forrestan is saying that from then on, he thinks Weber started playing a kind of double game in which he let his subscribers and collaborators believe he was continuing in the revisionist struggle, but in reality, he was already starting to scuttle the vessel entrusted to him. And in so let's go back to 1991, he tells a story of how Weber revealed being frightened at violence at a Munich conference where Ernst Sundel was there and Forrestan and a few others and Weber, and they were going to have a conference, and then these Antifas and Jewish defense people and so on got very violent, and they did do some injury to a few other people, and they were disrupting everything, and Weber, they all said, we're going to see this through, but Weber wanted to just pull out and leave. He can't handle that kind of a thing. You know, he can't handle that kind of attack and serious physical attacks. So then, in 1993, at a Washington D.C. dinner party, Forrestan tells a story of how he asked the question of all the people gathered there, whether the gas chambers truly existed, whether they believed gas chambers existed. And it went around, and everybody answered. And when he was there with Weber, and he was shocked when Weber said, well, maybe they did, at this, you know, in front of these people. And he said, he was so disgusted, he couldn't even talk to Weber for the rest of the night. And then he said the next day, a reporter from a black radio station called, and he heard Weber repeat that to that reporter, that it was not certain whether maybe there were gas chambers. So that was in 1993. Then from 1994 to 2002, Farazan says Weber sinks into inaction. And he says in this that long thing that he wrote, Weber has never published, either in English or any other language, a book or collection of articles, and in particular, no one has yet seen the manuscript of the work he was at one time fixing to bring out under the title, a provisional title of The Final Solution, Legend and Reality. And now, this was 94 to 2002 that Farazan has been talking about. Now, also, Germar Rudolph, in May 2002, and I brought this out in a previous program, wrote and published a long article and put it on his VHO site. IHR is a ship sinking, background and effects of a nine-year crisis. And Germar Rudolph, I am told, began speaking out against Weber around that time, and he has not had anything good to say about him since. Not that he goes and talks about him badly, but he hasn't, you know, he doesn't have a high opinion and doesn't think that he has been doing a good job, and he started that in 2002, made that public. And he also is critical of David Irving, who Weber has associated himself with, as far as his comments on revisionism and the Holocaust are concerned, not on other historical things. He just has said that David Irving is not a revisionist and he ought to keep his opinions to himself because he's causing more trouble than help. You know, that Rudolph said that when he was in the courtroom. At least that's when I heard it. I think it was Gunter Decker quoted that when he was covering Rudolph's trial. He didn't say it openly to the court. He said it, you know, privately, that he was just disgusted with the things David Irving was saying. And I think that was after he got out of the Austrian prison. But anyway, to go on, then Farazan says that at the lamentable International Congress of June 2002, I grasped that under Weber's sway, the IHR was perhaps heading toward a gradual abandonment of Holocaust revisionism. And on June 9, 2002, Arthur Butz wrote a critique with the title descriptively asking, Quo Vadis, that is, whither thou goest, examining the mission of IHR and the implications of O'Keefe's sacking. So it was around that time that O'Keefe was fired. I think it's because he made some comments critical of Weber. And the board, I forget what it was he was doing now. I read about that too. But anyway, they call it sacking, so they mean he was fired or forced out. And the Arthur Butz's message was directed to the IHR staff board and editorial advisory committee members only. I mean, he didn't do that publicly. He wrote it and sent it to them, to the IHR people. And but that Congress was the last, and subsequently from 2003 until now, which is now is 2012, so it's 9 years, Farazan says Weber was to prove, of course, he was writing this in 2009. Weber was to prove incapable of organizing an international conference worthy of the name. So Weber says, you know, he's very proud of the fact that he says he started having meetings and they're so successful. And they're like small gatherings of 8 to 15 people in the IHR office or office warehouse, using as a person who's been to them, says free booze to attract his supporters, and sometimes now he puts on a German film from the National Socialist period. They watch a film, things like that. I really don't know. Once in a while he has a speaker meeting with David Irving. That's about the only person that he has. He sets up sometimes, you know, it's the two of them and they both talk and the people come and listen. And then they, you know, talk around and schmooze afterwards and buy books and write checks for donations. So, in 2003, Forrest-san asked Weber to explain himself about his attitude toward the Holocaust, and Weber wouldn't do it. He sidestepped. So, Forrest-san says he submitted his resignation, and Guillermo Rudolph wrote to Forrest-san at this time, approved of what he was doing. He had long been a critic of Weber, and he approved of Forrest-san resigning from the IHR. Now, on December 15, 2003, to a question from Forrest-san, Weber finally replied, I do not like to say that the Nazi gas chambers never existed, in part because I do not regard myself as any kind of specialist of gas chambers, and in part because I avoid making such categorical statements on any subject. Now, if he is a historical revisionist, but he is afraid to make a categorical statement on any subject, or at least that's what he's saying here to explain why he won't make a statement about the gas chambers, whether they existed or didn't exist. In 2007, Fritz Berg, Bradley Smith, and some others again asked Weber to explain himself. And on September 23rd, 2008, Forrest-san received in the mail a sheet with the IHR letterhead signed by Weber and entitled A Productive Summer. It was a letter calling for donations, Forrest-san says, and he said, in his usual wit, rarely can such a misnomer of a title have been seen anywhere, because, it reported on a memorable IHR meeting on June 14, 2008, but the only two participants, Forrest-san says, at the meeting were Irving and Weber. The former told of his harrowing arrest in Austria, his sensational trial in Vienna, and his 13 months imprisonment there. He also spoke about wartime Germany's harsh treatment of Jews, presenting a view of the Holocaust similar to the one he laid out years ago in his book, Hitler's War. And Forrest-san says Irving has never in his life really disputed, quote, the Holocaust, unquote. So now in January 2009, Weber published that famous paper, How Relevant is Holocaust Revisionism? In February 2009, Forrest-san published a paper calling for Weber to resign from the IHR. Of course, Weber ignored that and continues to ignore all criticism of him from the revisionist community. And the reason why I say that Weber doesn't have the right to do that is what I expressed earlier, that their attitude toward Willis Carto, that it wasn't for him to decide what the IHR was going to be doing and what their mission was, but it was for all these revisionists who had been a part of starting this IHR. They were an integral part of them. It was a revisionist endeavor, Holocaust revisionism. Historical revisionism goes along with Holocaust revisionism, but you can do historical revisionism and ignore the Holocaust if you want. And that's what IHR does now. It doesn't even do historical revisionism, though. It has abdicated doing anything at all. And this is why, because of the history that I've kind of gone through here, people who say, well, Weber is now the director and Vord keeps him in place, and so that's their business. It's not your business to criticize and to say what he should be doing. It's nobody else's business. That isn't true. It isn't true that it's nobody else's business, because it has always been the business of the revisionist community. And when people say, well, start your own, that's the other argument they come up with. Start your own, start a new one, if you don't like what happened to that one. Well, that's not easy to do. You can't just start from nowhere when the IHR already has that website with all those articles that were done before Mark Weber took over. And he wrote a lot of them, but he was working there. He wasn't the head of the whole thing in its changed capacity. that it's in now. So they have all that. They have a huge inventory of books. They have the reputation. They have the history of it. They own the journal of Historical Review, even though it stopped being published. The old issues are still there, and all those articles that are in them. I'm going to go into that a little bit in the second hour. So all of that material is there, and you don't just kiss that goodbye and say, well, we'll start from scratch somewhere else, you know, or something new. You can't do it. So that belongs to the revisionist community, and it should go back to him. And Mark Weber should resign. He should. If he had any decency, he would do it. And we would put someone who could really do the job in there. I recommended Guillermo Rudolph previously, and I didn't know if he would want to do it. I don't see why he wouldn't, but he would be really good. And then things could get going again. So we will go into that more, ladies and gentlemen, in the second hour, and into some other people, too. I took kind of a long time with this, probably too long, but that's the way it goes. So hang on, and we'll be back after this five-minute musical interlude. And this is Carolyn Yeager with the Heretics Hour on July 16th. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I think we're back. I think that's the end of the music. This is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour on July 16th. And I am talking about, I'm supposed to be talking about fundraising, but I got carried away with all these details, which I had looked up about Mark Weber's history at the IHR. But now we're going to get into the fundraising part. Because, you know, the point is, the first part was, what is being accomplished now by this organization? Well, this one I can really say that I think nothing's being accomplished. It hasn't been for a long time. And very important or very respectable and believable and credible and accomplished people have made a very clear case that Mark Weber doesn't get anything done and hasn't done anything and has brought the IHR to a standstill. And it is now an institute where nothing is happening except that he now just started doing a podcast once a week in which he goes over things that old material, so to speak. And people find them interesting. There's no question he's always been known to be a good speech maker, and he can put on an interesting program. It's kind of slow, but he can do that. But is that enough for this big organization that used to be so active and that all this money has been given to, and all this, it still gets quite a bit of money, considering what I would think of as a lot of money. I mean, if you end up with $100,000 a year, which is peanuts compared to what it used to be doing, but that's still a lot of groups would be absolutely thrilled with that. I don't know even what they do with it. I don't know what the IHR does with it. But anyway, Mark Weber is always sending out fundraising emails. He sends out his news clipping service. Now he seems to be sending it out more often, maybe almost every other day. He sends one out, and in interspersed every couple of weeks or so, he sends out one. Please consider sending money to us. We need money. We need money. And recently, he sent something out that he sent out a fundraising letter, and then he sent out, the usual one. Then he sent out something that their website was attacked. They thought it was the JDL, the Jewish Defense League, and they needed help. Please support us because we're right on the front line. They're attacking us because we're doing such a great job, because we're so effective against them. Ha! And then he sent out some more of the news clippings, and then came the second fundraising letter. And I have that here, and it says, behind the latest attack, who hacked the IHR website? Then it says, progress despite threats, smears, and intimidation. And dear friends, the recent cyber attack against the IHR is only the latest in a long run of assaults by bigots and hate groups. We don't even know if there was a cyber attack on the IHR website. It wasn't down. It wasn't, that anybody noticed. And he said no harm was done and nothing, but they think it was. They think it was. But now he's building it up into a sure thing. And he's saying, he goes on to say, in this July 4th attack, it happened on the 4th of July, hackers apparently infected our main website with malware. Oh, my. Shutting it down for about 14 hours. Fortunately, no passwords, addresses, or email messages were stolen or compromised. There's apparently no permanent damage, and we've taken measures to prevent this from happening again. Who's behind this latest attack? Well, here's what we know, he says. A few hours after the attack, we received an email notice, the first ever, from the Jewish Defense League. In his July 4th message, JDL director Meyer Weinstein warned that he and his outfit are committed to confront sophisticated, well-funded, and effective groups that are hostile to Israel and its supporters. Why doesn't he post this email? You see, we haven't seen this. He's just saying that they received an email notice from the Jewish Defense League. It was a July 4th message. I think he, you know, why doesn't he show that email to us? That would be the right thing to do, because I don't know if this email message, if there even was one, was really what he's making it out to be. It might have been something where that was something was just mentioned, but it was about other things. And I don't know. He said we received an email notice. Moreover, this new cyber attack and the JDL notice came precisely on the anniversary of a devastating firebombing of the Institute's offices by the Jewish Defense League. It was on July 4th, 1984, that the Jewish Defense League carried out an arson attack against the IHR's offices and warehouse. 28 years ago, folks, 28 years ago that happened, in 1984, when Mark Weber was just a small potatoes, he wasn't running anything. And, that was a terrible thing that happened, but nothing like that has happened since, because the IHR has become less and less, of a threat, seems to me. That's why. And now he finds a little malware in their computer program and says that, well, this is related. This is who it is. And they're out to get us. And therefore, he's using this to get more money. He talks about that attack in 1984 and then he says, I regard such attacks as a badge of honor. Everybody likes to do that. If they get written up by the ADL or somebody says something about it and say, oh, I'm so proud. This is a badge of honor. Well, I was written up by both the ADL and the SPLC. And I never went around bragging about it. They just look for people who they think are, you know, enemies of theirs, and they write articles about them. So what? Anyway, he says that he regards this as a badge of honor and an affirmation of our impact and effectiveness. So, you know, this is how he's trying to point this out, that they're so effective because this event happened, this little hacking event. And therefore, he says, he goes on talking about how the Jabotinsky International Center, a militant Zionist group based in Israel, calls the IHR particularly dangerous because our website has a professional layout and well-written material. Well, this was a little review that the Jabotinsky Center had on the IHR in March 2010, over 2 years ago. And, you know, they write things like that about, everything that they're against. That again is being kind of misused there. It's being made out to be more than it is. And, because, you know, what they say is, oh, well, the IHR tries to be, present itself as scholarly. They're really just a hate group, just like all the rest, but, you know, they try to look more professional. And, you know, that's all. That's all they were saying. And they say things about everybody. So this is not a special, they're not especially targeting the IHR. And he says, then Mark says, despite years of threats, smears, slander, and intimidation, we're proud of what we've accomplished. No similar group, certainly none with a comparably modest budget and staff. He has a bigger budget and staff. He doesn't have a staff, but he has more money than most people, most any groups that I know of have, for sure, because of the history of the IHR, because of the prestige that it gained, because of the long record that it has. So it's not what he's doing now that is accomplishing so much. But he says they have this record of focus and achievement. Yeah, in the past. Not now. So, and he ends, to carry on, we need sustained support from men and women like you, underlined, like you, who understand what's at stake and who care about our nation, our world, and our future. Please help. Faithfully yours, Mark Weber. Director, Institute for Historical Review. Well, you know, he's got his hand out all the time, and this is what these organizations do, but still, he needs to be questioned on what they're actually accomplishing. He really does. But most people that talk to me, or that I might talk to, say, well, he's doing something. As long as he's doing something, that's good. You know, that's good enough, or that's better than nothing. No, it's not good enough. It's not better than nothing. Somebody could be in there with that reputation of that organization, and really doing something. He is keeping it from doing anything. He's not, this little bit that he does, is not something to be proud of. You know, it's not something, some reason to say, well, leave him alone because I like listening to his, podcasts, you know. Well, I guess he could do those podcasts, even if he wasn't the director, even if somebody else was the director, he could still be doing the things he does if he really cared about the cause, rather than do we have to ask him, does he only care about having this position and until he's of retirement age, and then maybe he will get a retirement package, but he has a place to go every day, a phone line to talk on the phone to whoever he wants, and does his little stuff that he does there. Not much. And it makes him feel like somebody. So, but how much does he care about the white race? He says he's not a white nationalist. What does he care about? He cares about Mark Weber. That's all I can think of. So, I don't want to spend the time to read what he has said about the Goebbels diaries and why he says that, or what he wrote about why the Holocaust is not relevant anymore, because I think people have read that, and I don't want to just read over that. So I will just move on to maybe I could go a little bit into some things that Rodney Martin said, because Rodney Martin has worked with Mark Weber for quite a while, and he was a generous donor to the IHR, and he also gave his help, his expertise and his help with film festivals and setting up some meetings, and he gave a lot of advice to Mark, and Mark was depending on Rodney quite a bit, and of course, depending on the money that Rodney was giving, he was pretty generous, not only with monthly, regular monthly donations of several hundred dollars, but special, paid for special things into the thousands of dollars. So, he's, and Roddy Martin has a lot of, criticism of Mark Weber, and he doesn't do any of that anymore. He finally wised up. You know, he retired and he had money, he had time, and he wanted to do something worthwhile with it. And he lives in that area, and he went to the IHR thinking this would be a good place for him to help, you know, help the cause and so on. But he eventually learned differently. So he doesn't have anything good to say about it now, and he's trying to do something on his own. But you know, the IHR is the place to do it from, so it's hard for people to start something from scratch on their own. It really is. And now Hattie Scott has written that about this Goebbels thing, which deals with both David Irving and Mark Weber, who's just saying what he's just parroting David Irving. But Hattie says that there's, that because of the Goebbels diaries, it proves that a couple million Jews were killed in the East, which it doesn't, but that's part of what they use. And they, Irving has said that the Goebbels diaries are absolutely authentic. And Hattie says there's great doubt about the authenticity of the entire Gebel's diaries because they are written on typewriter. These are not the actual diary pages when they talk about the Goebbels' diaries. This is a typewritten copy of it that is in the Soviet Union or is in Russia that was held by the Soviet Union for so long, and there are supposedly glass plates of these typewritten pages. So somebody typed it up. And so Hattie says there's no real way of verifying if they are accurate, and the U.S. government certified in the beginning of the publication that they published it, that it can take, that the U.S. government takes no responsibility for the accuracy of the diaries. So, and Hattie also points out that these using these diaries as proof of anything, you have to remember that Goebbels had no responsibility for Jewish policy. He wasn't involved in that. He was the propaganda minister. He was involved only in the only to the extent that there were Jews in Berlin, and he was responsible for Berlin, and he wanted the government to get the Jews out of Berlin. Goebbels wanted Hitler to make Berlin a priority and to remove Jews from Berlin first, you know, or as soon as possible. So he was anxious to have that done. That's it. And he was requesting that. So, okay. Hattie also says the most obvious criticism of Weber is that he has abandoned the purpose of the organization and therefore ought to turn it over to somebody else who is committed to that purpose. It's not about fighting Jewish Zionist power. He said the purpose of the IHR was never about fighting Jewish Zionist power, which is what Weber is doing now. It's about promoting truth in history. That's why it's called the Institute for Historical Review, promoting truth in history. And we want the truth, even if it's not about the Jews. I mean, even if it's not hurtful to the Jews, we want to know what the truth is. And that's what we're after. We're not after bringing down Jewish Zionist power in that organization. There's lots of others doing that, and so it's kind of like something that was unique to the IHR has been abandoned in order to join what everybody else is doing now, to just talk about Zionists and Zionism. All right. Another thing about Mark Weber that I want to mention, which has nothing to do with fundraising, but in a sense it does, because Hattie Scott had talked about how Mark plagiarized from him and put something in something he was writing. Another thing I want to tell you is that I remembered the person I was trying to think whose name I couldn't remember, Paul Grubach. Paul Grubach is the revisionist who really started going after Mark Weber and really started a campaign to get Mark Weber removed, and that was started a couple years ago, and 3 years ago maybe, and we see Mark is still there. So it's not easy to do. It's not easy to do because the board of directors belongs to him. I mean, they support him, and he makes sure that his supporters are there, and any that aren't have been taken off. So it's all kind of tied up. It's too bad, but Paul Grubach used to be a real supporter of Mark Weber, and he's become really against him now, really, really against him, because, you know, he's a revisionist who cares about this, and it's all revisionists are just sickened by how this happened. But in any event, Rodney Martin and I did a program, Heretics Hour program, on February 28th of this year, last February, and it was called Nazi Germany's First in Science, Medicine, and Health, and we talked about the patents that the Allies had stolen without giving any compensation. Of course, nobody had to give anything to Germany. They could just take everything they wanted. And we talked about the emphasis in during the Nazi regime on public health, preventive medicine, and went a lot into the war on cancer, the anti-smoking campaign, which was the first in the world, way before anybody else. And they discovered even asbestos, how dangerous asbestos was. And they were doing a lot of other things, and we talked about that well-known book about cancer that somebody, I don't have that with me in front of me right now, wrote about it. And then it was a two-hour program, and then on April 18th, less than 2 months later, Mark Weber, on his report, which hadn't been going for too long, on VOR, which this program was on VOR, you know, my Heretics Hour program, did a program, Public Health Policy in the Third Reich, Germany, talked about the same things, talked about mainly the health policy, medical research, and the war on cancer, which included restrictions on asbestos and carcinogenic pesticides and public smoking, anti-smoking campaign, and so on. Same thing he did. I thought that was kind of odd. I really did. Because I know you can't say that he didn't know, because he always listened to my program. He told me a couple years ago, or maybe not quite that long, but that he was a regular listener to my program. That's before he started back on VOR himself. So he is kind of a, you know, I have called him a copier. He doesn't do much original. He gets ideas from here and there from what other people are doing, and then he does it himself. And that's just another example of that. All right, I'm going to now spend a little time talking about someone who's a real icon in our movement. And I'm going to start with her because she's also, I consider, a revisionist. And talking about Mark Weber, we're talking about the revisionist community. After that, it's people who are more like white nationalists. But Ingrid Zundel, of course, has a fairly long history since she got involved with Ernst Zundel, and is held in high esteem by most people. And I have some problems sometimes with she's another one who I say she keeps asking for money. She's always they needed money when they needed a lot of lawsuits and so on, when they needed to help Ernst in all of his legal problems. So they were getting lots and lots of money in at that time. I don't know but you get used to that. You know, you get used to collecting money, people sending money. People get used to sending money to you. The question is, you know, what's being done with it now? Ingrid sends out this power letter, and I want to talk about that a little bit because it's basically a fundraising letter, and she says in here and there, and always ends with reminding people that she needs their help, and she sends a envelope with it, with her address typed on it, so you can send your donation in. Sometimes she's selling things, but in her letters, which is a little bit better. But sometimes she doesn't put any of the things she has for sale, her tapes and even sometimes books and so on. And I've bought things from her. I used to donate, and then I started trying to buy things instead of just sending money for nothing. And then I got kind of discouraged, fed up, and decided that wasn't where I wanted my money to go. But she starts out, I mean, she ends up with something like this. Sometimes it's longer than this, but we'll never surrender. We'll never give up. I count on your support, and thank you very much in advance. Of course, she's talking about financial support. And she says if I can get myself in the right place here, in the beginning, on page one, it's always an 8-page letter. She talks about the library on her property there in Tennessee and how she has built this beautiful library. She sent out a color brochure type thing on it a few months ago. Very large, big reception area. And she says that it's all completed now. She does all that with donations. And she's got it filled. She's got 24,000 high quality hardcover books that people have donated. And plus all the other soft covers and CDs and DVDs. It's electronically secured and monitored. A deck will be constructed next week. I hope to have the place landscaped and paved. Provided my supporters chip in, I trust we will take the last hurdle together. And there are more ambitious plans for coming times. Well, she has every right to write to people that are on her list and ask for their support and help. At least she tells what the project is. I mean, I'm always saying that, you know, you need to tell people what it is that you're going to do with the money. Then you're more likely to get money, and you shouldn't get money for the people who don't know what you're going to do with it. Well, she is doing that. But what are they going to do with this place? It seems to be kind of a shrine to, like it's going to be a place to remember Ernst Zundel. At least it'll be that, you know, and it'll be all kinds of stuff of his there. And that is probably a good thing to have, because this man is quite, his story is so amazing. And he suffered so much at the hands of this horrible global world government that we have. So, you know, it's and it would be a place for hopefully for revisionism, but I don't know what, you know, that there are any plans yet for it to be used, or if how welcome people are to go there, or would have to be maybe a meeting once in a while. I just don't know the real purpose of this, except it's something that she wants, and she's got this property and she wants to turn it into a place like this, but I never hear of anybody being invited to do anything there. So that's one of my questions. Another thing I want to bring up here is that she's got this thing about Gordon Duff. You know, she says she's featured two major Veterans Today pieces written by our friend Gordon Duff. She's his friend, and she wants all of her people that she knows to like Gordon Duff too. She says, those of you who read the Veterans Today website on the net, please bear with me. Our list consists mostly of people who are a bit shy about cyberspace and appreciate reading the articles in print, because Ingrid's 8-page power letter is always things I've already read on the internet. Or I could read on the internet if I wanted to. You know, and I guess she gets people, right? Other people, I've never told her that, but people tell her that, that why do you put all this stuff that's from the internet when we can all look at it? And so she's saying, well, she does it because most of the people on her list they're not on the internet so much. And so this is all new to them, so she can just present them whatever stuff she just copies off of the internet, copy and paste, puts it down there, and I guess they're happy, and they're the ones maybe who send the most money. So she puts in, she's got about almost 4 pages of the 8 pages, just Gordon Duff, and 2 articles by Gordon Duff. And, you know, Gordon Duff is just like he's crazy. I mean, he's certifiably insane, if you ask me. He doesn't tell the truth about anything, hardly. I don't know why she's so in love with him, but she is. And I don't mean literally in love with him, but she started writing. She doesn't even write. She does the same thing in her articles on Veterans Today, or her column. She takes other people's articles and writings, and she writes some introduction, and she posts them there. And a lot of people who are there who are new to all this, they think that she's written all that. They're always getting all confused about it because it's not made as clear as it should be. But anyway, these articles by Gordon Duff, they're just terrible. You know, one is a long one, Memorial Day, Time to Ask Why. And he just rambles from here to there all over the place. And the other one, though, is worse. It's an open letter to President Obama. And he is, like, complaining to Obama. But Gordon Duff has been an Obama supporter. He absolutely hates Republicans. And he makes a point of attacking Christians and Christianity all the time. And he makes Republicans out to be the real evil in the world, and therefore, and Christians too, and all Christians are, he thinks of as Christian Zionists, and he just rambles around, like I'm kind of doing right now. I thought I had some things marked, but I don't see them, so, And then, let me look at my notes here. In his latest article, Gordon Duff, not the ones that she has in her paper, in her power letter, but he writes that, here's some examples of Duff. We don't do nothing, he writes. And He's trying to make every white person out to be a Gomer Pyle, a stupid person, doesn't know anything. And he's racing around covering everything that pops in his mind and saying that everything is a lie. Everything, that's a basic, theme of this letter. Everything is a lie. Everything is a lie. Don't believe anything. We can't believe anything. And here's some things he said. He said one intelligence officer, he's always, you know, making out that he's friends with all these intelligence officers, that they all talk to him and they all give him all the inside dope and he knows everything, Gordon. So he says one intelligence officer was telling me today, Gordon, I need a new line of work. It's impossible to raise kids and live a normal life and know that almost every world leader is a stooge and that what we are told every day is a hollow fiction, primarily so people won't all kill themselves. And, you know, I think he made that up. Gordon just made that up. No intelligence officer told him that. And then he says, then he starts talking about the death camps and the Holocaust. And he does that every so often. He makes a lot of mistakes. But he just rambles on about it. He says, speaking of a wooden door he's talking about, Auschwitz. Speaking of a wooden door with a glass window in a death camp gas chamber, he said, I think it had a sign on it. Don't break the glass or door. Don't break the glass or door through any child could do it because the poison gas will get out. You know, it doesn't say that. It doesn't have a sign like that. He made that up too. And then he says a little bit further on, my own visits were as a Jewish parent taking his children, not as a historical revisionist. Well, he starts talking about himself being Jewish. He is part Jewish, and he brings that up quite a bit. In this article, he talked about something on the History Channel, the last days of World War II. And, well, you know, anybody can be smarter than what's on the History Channel, but In talking about that, he says, Europe is filled with my ancestors. Like most Americans, Europe is filled with my ancestors. Well, it's getting to be where most Americans are not Europeans, but anyway, we'll pass that by. He says, I have Scots afraid I will ask for one of the family castles. Well, there's a lie. You know, I'm sure he's pretending now that his Scottish ancestors all had big castles. And he might come along and somehow ask for one of them. Then he says, I have Germans from Posen, every single one of them, 1,000 years in residence, dead. Like his German ancestors were 1,000 years in this place were there for 1,000 years. I don't think so. Then he says, then he tries to act like he's exposing the lies about Hitler and the World War II and so on. But then he'll tell them. He'll stick in some new ones. He'll stick some in there. Like he says, Donovan, speaking of the head of the OSS, Donovan was working for the consortium behind Stalin. Dulles was working for Hitler and later became head of the CIA and so on and so on. Well, Dulles wasn't working for Hitler, but, you know, that's the kind of stuff Duff pushes. And so I don't understand why Ingrid Zundel, if she has any sense, is so taken up by him and keeps promoting him. In every one of her power letters, she puts in something by Gordon Duff. And, you know, it seems to me that Ingrid Zundel attracts, and on her website, Zundel's site, she has a special box with a big link to Veterans Today. So you can click on there and go. And she says that, oh, I forgot to read this part. She says that, where is that? Anyway, somewhere she says that it must be over here, that the best, oh, here it is. Veterans Today is simply the best source for reliable alternative intel that I know. It's always cutting edge information presented with facts as well as raw emotions. The world that we knew is coming unglued, and I consider it important for the record to feature the most genuine voices I can find. Well, she means the voices on Veterans Today. So there's something wrong there with Ingrid Zundel's, or I'd rather call her Ingrid Rimland's, judgment about things. And she ends up attracting a lot of goofy people who don't know anything about it, but they think that because of her name, you know, she's somebody that's really somebody that they can follow. And they think that she's written all the stuff that she posts. Just everything. It's just, I don't see that it's that there's anything there helping the movement. So I don't know how much money goes in that direction. And maybe it's from people who, if they didn't send it to her, they wouldn't send it anywhere. So I don't know. But now I'm going to go on to another great icon who I have nothing personally against at all. I think pretty well of him, and that's Dr. David Duke. And I looked at his I look over his website, and I'm wondering, you know, what he's really standing for these days, because I noticed too much in his radio programs that he talks about he talks about support. You know, he talks about his things, his books and his trips and his radio program. He promotes himself. He's a big self-promoter, really, really big at self-promoting now. And then he'll go and say kind of the same things about Israel every show, the things that he believes about it. And then he'll finally get around to his guest. You know, he spends about half his program on himself and half his program for his guest. And but on his website where he says, here's how you can help. Here's how you can help me, or here's how you can help David Duke. He writes, no one is accomplishing more in waking up the European and American people than David Duke. This is written in the third person. His videos and writings are now reaching tens of millions of people all over the globe. Tens of millions of people? Well, I don't know. Between his videos and his books, how many do you think tens of millions of people are watching them? And then all over the globe, well, what does that mean? We'll get to that in a minute. It says his principles are not only applicable to Europeans, but a real path to progress and peace for all people on earth. And more, David Duke is directing himself to all people. And he says sometimes he makes it clear that that all people need to have self-determination, and that's what he's talking about. People identifying with their own ethnicity, race, and culture, and being able to determine, you know, have their own national group and determine their own way. But when he talks about all people on earth, he gets a little carried away with that. And he sounds a lot like a minister, a preacher, or a pastor, who is giving the ultimate message, you know, of love and, truth and so on for all people on, of the earth. Anyway, we keep this page goes on. Zionist globalism is, an enemy of Europeans and truly the heritage, freedom, and independence of all people. So Zionist globalism is the enemy of not only Europeans, but all people. And the easiest and most effective way to support him, meaning David Duke, is with a generous personal gift, because that, this is not written very well, because that there are no taxes on personal gifts, and he can utilize every penny in his creativity and work for our ideals. Well, what is this work? You know, when I start looking at this stuff, I start to really get a little irritated and really wonder. David Duke stands up and speaks for you. Your kind and generous gift makes it possible for him to speak to the entire world. Again, there's this entire world business. He's getting into that more and more. But now, then there's gift information under that. Amounts from the EU and your credit is secure. Okay. Then he says, I want to make a gift to Dr. David Duke. Well, that's nothing wrong with that. But then you can become a patron and make a recurring gift each month, and you have to put in the amount. But now we come to the Euro organization. I want to join David Duke's Euro organization. Well, I never found what that was, but I do know that he has put on a Euro conference for quite a few years. I don't know when it started, but I have some of the years here, or if he has done it in the last couple of years. I don't know. But I know when I had Heinrich Halappa on, he said he spoke, well, yeah, I think it was the 2008. I saw that. It was a little clip of Heinrich's talk. It was a short one, but it was good. And that was David Duke's Euro conference. I think it was in Tennessee that year. So this must be what he does. He puts on this conference. And it says, Euro members are a worldwide dedicated brotherhood of men and women who defend European heritage and human rights. Okay. There are three categories of membership. Now, do they really defend? You know, what is this thing doing? You know, it's talking about it does this. It's a brotherhood. Is it actually doing anything? It says Euro Prime members pay a recurring. You can be a Prime member, a principal member, or an elite member. And if you're a Prime member, you pay a recurring fee of $10 or 10 euros a month. So, you put up your credit card and it's going to take out $10 every month to David Duke. It says it's expected that all members will make added contributions on important projects from time to time. It's expected. It's expected that all of these Prime members will make more contributions on special projects from time to time. Now, to be a principal member, you have to give $20 or 20 euros a month, and you're supporting on a more active level. You are considered, principal members are considered David Duke's advisors and are provided with special email and communication numbers and a special access portal and a password on www.davidduke.com. Now, this kind of bothered me because this is like selling yourself. You know, so well, if you give at least $20 a month, every month, then I will consider you an advisor. And you can send me email at this special address, and I'll read it, and I'll answer you. So it doesn't matter whether you're how intelligent you are or how good your advice is, but how much money you're giving. So this reminds me back of the kings the time of the noblemen or the aristocracy or something, or just the idea of people being bought. Or it's very similar to the Jews thing. You know, the way the person with the money is the person who has the influence. So it's a little bit troublesome. But then we have the elite members. It just goes a little further. You pledge $50 or $100 a month. I don't know. I guess you can choose. You're still elite if you pledge 50 or if you want to go to 100 a month, every month. Think how, if he really had these members, how much that would give him for his work. And every elite member is automatically a member of Dr. Duke's inner circle of advisors and is entitled to a private telephone or personal conference with Dr. David Duke on matters of importance. So there again, he's selling his time to these people who want to talk to him. He's making himself out to be kind of a very special character who's very busy and doesn't have much time. But if you are one of the good contributors, a really good contributors, $100 a month, that's $1,200 a year. Well, I guess it's not a huge amount of money, but it's something that he could depend on. Then you get to talk to him, and he'll even talk to you on the telephone. So I don't know how many people go in for this or if it's just there and nobody does it. But anyway, it's I found it interesting. And it says here that Euro is not connected to any other organization, past or present. It is a part of the David Duke Foundation. Now, I looked for the David Duke Foundation, and I couldn't find anything on it at all. So I don't know, maybe foundations are not public, that public, or I don't know whether David Duke actually has a real legal foundation or if he just calls it that or what. So those are my questions for Mr. Duke if I were going to talk to him. Now here's something else. You know, he spends a lot of time building himself up. You know, I'm sorry I have to say these things, but here on another page on his website, it says, "Can you help me reach out to our people?" So he's constantly asking for, you know, he asks for help in different ways, but it's the same kind of help. Now he says, listen to this. "My presence is needed in a number of places across America and around the Western world." His presence is needed. In a lot of places. He can't be in all those places, I guess. "Wherever I can, I donate my precious time to traveling and speaking to groups who are at the forefront of leadership for our heritage and freedom." Well, he does travel around and speak. He does. "Many of them can little afford any honorarium for me, much less the airfare and travel expenses." So he, even though he gets a lot of donations, if he has to go and speak somewhere, he expects that the airfare and travel expenses would be paid if he would come and be a speaker for you. So that's what he's saying there. And that's pretty standard. But he says, "That's okay, for I'm willing to donate my time, but frankly, I need help in covering the airline and other travel expenses. I'm anxious to awaken and motivate our people, and I have the skills necessary to instruct leaders and activists in effective organization and politics. Perhaps you could help me in this endeavor?" He asks. You may be someone reading this. Oh, if you, this is not written well. I don't know who writes this stuff. If you have a large amount of airline miles or reward points from your credit card use over the years, one way you can really help David's work easily is by your transferring needed airline reward points or miles to my SkyMiles account. That's clever, huh? Sometimes that method has a small surcharge, but if you speak to me personally, it is easy for me to tell you how you can get the actual tickets for me with no extra charge whatsoever. This is one great way to help my efforts with little or no cost to you." I have some important events coming up in some distant places that your airline rewards miles or points could help make possible my participation. If you don't have any credit card award points, Of course, your monetary gifts would be very welcome and appreciated. Right now, I am doing a schedule for the next few months, and I truly need your help in this endeavor, if it is at all possible for you to do so. Send me an email, and please include your phone number, and I will contact you personally to give you the details of how you can help me. If you can't help with miles or points, you can make a gift at the donate button right here. Thank you, he says, very much in actually doing something for our cause rather than just agreeing at the back of the crowd. I thank you sincerely. So, yes, you know, money speaks. Money speaks. I don't know. I don't know because I don't know what kind of money these people are getting. You know, that's the kind of the point here is we see what the IHR has been getting, but I don't know if these people get how much Ingrid gets. She has some big donors. They've had huge donors, but I don't know now, you know, David Duke must have some pretty big donors, and he works at it a lot to get as much as he can. So we don't know how much money he's getting. Now, I don't have hardly any time, but Greg Johnson has had, on Countercurrents, has had a fundraising drive. That website has only been up for 2 years, although Greg has been involved in the movement in Occidental Quarterly and so on for quite a few more years than that. But he said it was going on for 2 months and their goal was $25,000. I thought that sounded like an awful lot, but you have to aim high to get anything. It's true. And after looking at the IHR numbers again and figures, I think, well, $25,000 is not too high to aim for if you're actually fundraising. But again, what are they going to do with it? Now, they're not anywhere close to that yet. And I hope, I have to truly say, I hope they don't get it, but don't get that much. But it still goes on, and people do send in, although they haven't gotten any huge amounts. Or if they do get large amounts from somebody, I suppose it wouldn't be published. These would be background people who don't want it, who are doing a special contribution maybe. But money, you know, I think because there is quite a bit of money, and I think that it is necessary to examine what's being done with it. And to go back to where I started, if what is being done is what you think needs to be done, or if it's really seriously helping us, or if it's just kind of another good thing that's being done, if it's just more of the same, or you know, paying writers to write more articles and write more books and so on, if it's aimed at really stopping white genocide. And of course, in my opinion, the best way to stop white genocide is to expose the Holocaust hoax for what it is, and to overturn all of those lies that are the basis of Jewish power. People say they're not, but they are. And therefore, I target most, I'm most interested in the IHR and Mark Weber and making a change there. And if I would ask anything of my listeners and of people, I would say, please think about that and add your voice to that and do what you can to bring pressure to bear on the board of directors at the IHR to resign, or to let Mark Weber go, and to bring on board someone like Germar Rudolph, and bring the IHR back to a Holocaust revisionist institute. I think, in my opinion, that would be one of the best things that we could do in this time, in this moment, you know, in 2012, to get something really worthwhile going again. And there are a lot of revisionists out there that would participate in that, and it would be an institute that was very active again, at examining all the hoaxes that we've been living through and overturning them and functioning from a place where there was real support for it, real financial support. So this is what I would hope to come from this program. I don't know if it's a very good program for doing that, but also to come from it, to become more aware of where the money is going, to become more aware that there is a lot of money, because there's so many people, there's a lot of money out there. Where is it going and how is it being used? And we do have to see, it's our responsibility. It's not butting into other people's business. It's our responsibility to see that our resources are going to do the best job for us and our progeny and our children and our future. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to another Heretics Hour. I will be back again next week, Carolyn Yeager, at the same time. Tune in then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.